So good evening and welcome to the JLI course, Decisions of Faith. Just from a quick glance, it looks like most of you are returned students to JLI, but I know at least one of you are first-time JLI students. So welcome, Octavia. Okay, so welcome and thank you for joining. And we could look forward to a fascinating and insightful journey. All JLI courses are fascinating and insightful, but of course each one has its specific topic or agenda, and this is certainly to be the case for medical ethics. So just a couple things before we actually jump in. What is this course about? What is it? What isn't it? Couple of notes. Number one, it's very important to be talking about these topics, especially nowadays. What are we talking about? We're talking about ethics from a Torah perspective, from a Jewish perspective. And it's necessary to discuss these ideas from a Torah perspective, especially today. Look around and you see that values are very often thrown out the window. Especially important values, especially ones that relate to life and death. If that's the case, if that's those are the risks and the dangers that we're living in a time like this, then it's especially important to refresh and remind ourselves and study these ideas so that we remain anchored in time-tested, true Torah values. That's number one. Number two, another idea that's important to realize, that as we'll see it already tonight and in all of the classes, we're not going to necessarily, I should say most certainly, we will not be encountering consensus when it comes to these big issues in Jewish law. In fact, there's an idea in Jewish law that says, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, which means that both opinions are both the word of the living God. Now, how's that possible? How can both be the word of the living God? It's either this way or that way. So, as far as the law is concerned, so yes, there's only one way to actually fulfill a certain mandate in Torah, and there's mechanisms of how you determine what the decision is, and we'll see some examples tonight. Even after there is a decision made, nonetheless, the other opinion still has validity. It doesn't have validity as far as what we do, but it has validity as far as the theory behind it, meaning there's something to it. There's something divine, even in the opinion that we don't actually follow. So it's important to realize that when it comes to these, especially these sensitive issues, not always is there consensus, very often not, and not necessarily do different authorities see things the same way. Very often they don't. Nonetheless, that there's value in that too. And what we're really going to get enlightened to in this course is really it's about the process. It's not really about the decision. The decision needs to be made when a certain case is, when you're faced and confronted by a certain reality, then yes, then it's time to go to a rabbi, an expert on, in this case, medical ethics, and you need a decision, that's the time to get a decision. But outside of that, it's important to appreciate what the process is. What is the rabbi kind of going through? What are his struggles as he tries to come to a decision when it comes to a delicate matter in Jewish law? Just some opening thoughts and clarifications. So yeah, all makes sense so far. So let's launch in. As we said, it's lesson one tonight, experimental treatments, and we're going to open with a case study. One second, did I not say a joke yet?
No, not yet.
All right, I'm gonna get fired. So the synagogue was packed. It was Yom Kippur. And there was a woman sitting in the women's section in the synagogue, and suddenly she started screaming, a doctor, a doctor. And somebody you know, this young doctor wasn't far away. He came over and she said, are you a doctor? And she looks him up and down and says, do I have a girl for you? So yes, we know what a doctor means in Judaism, and we'll see theologically too, we'll discover tonight what the role of doctors in Judaism is. So let's take a look first. Very often classes will open with a case study, and it's going to be something that we'll kind of use as a platform to be able to explore the various big ideas of the lesson. So let's take a look.
When Radha Patel first entered the world, nothing seemed amiss. She was a bright-eyed child who had met her early milestones until it came to walking. She went for physical therapy, but her initial progress suddenly slowed dramatically. Soon after her second birthday, Radha was given a brain and spine MRI and genetic analysis. The results were devastating. MLD, metachromatic leukodystrophy.
Metachromatic leukodystrophy, or MLD, is really a devastating condition. It's a single gene disorder. Children are born normally, but in the most severe form of the disease, after a year or so, they start to lose normal function. They stumble, they lose the ability to walk, they're confined to wheelchairs, they have epileptic seizures. And in the most severe form of the disease, 50% of children unfortunately die by the age of 5, and there's almost 100% mortality by the age of 10.
Radha's prognosis was grim. The Patels sprang into action, researching fanatically for a cure in a race against time. Surely, they reasoned, in an era of gene editing technologies, there must be a cure for a single enzyme deficiency. Sure enough, Shire, a biotech company specializing in rare disease solutions, was developing an MLD treatment. But there was a catch. Medicines require extensive testing and collaboration. The good news was that Shire had started the process. Their phase 1 trial delivered the required rudimentary degree of safety and effectiveness. Shire was gearing up for phase 2, a comprehensive trial to complete the process. The bad news was that the second trial would occur in several months' time, and that would be too late. For the drug to be effective, Radha needed it immediately. But the Patels were optimistic. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration runs an expanded access program, also known as compassionate use, that approves investigational stage medication. At the time, the program worked like this. A doctor with a terminally ill patient who had no other treatment options could ask a pharmaceutical company for an investigational drug that had undergone a phase 1 trial. If they agreed, the doctor could apply for FDA's consent. With those two approvals in hand, the patient could access the coveted cure. On their end, the FDA simplified the procedure and granted almost all requests. However, getting the companies to agree was another story. Companies need to demonstrate that their products are safe for public consumption. They are reluctant to provide a drug prematurely outside of a clinical trial. What if the patient suffers injury or death for reasons not directly related to the drug? Will that unfairly torpedo their chance of receiving FDA certification? That's a valid concern, which the FDA has addressed, but for some companies, it is not enough. Corporations have another fear. If they freely provide individuals with experimental drugs, they will have a hard time finding candidates to participate in their trials. Put simply, they might save a few lives in the interim, but fail to complete a drug that could save countless future lives. Is that concern valid in a case like Radha's? Certainly not. If a patient with a fast-moving disease is not treated immediately, they will be unavailable for future trials. Radha's doctor asked Shire for the drug. To their dismay, the request was denied, with no clear reason provided. All approaches to the company were rebuffed, and Radha's only hope was dashed. The federal government has since allowed terminally ill patients and their doctors to bypass the FDA.
Good news, in my opinion, actually, unadulterated good news. The right to try legislation has passed the House. This bill allows terminally ill patients to try experimental drugs and treatments that may not have received FDA approval.
However, it refuses to force the hands of the pharmaceutical industry and the keys to life remain in the pocket of individual corporate decision makers. This leaves us with some dilemmas. Experimental drugs can be highly potent. They have not yet been approved as safe and effective. Is it appropriate to supply them to people suffering from life-threatening illnesses? And if so, under which circumstances? And is it appropriate for governments to compel drug companies to provide access? If so, under which circumstances?
Okay, so that's our case. Obviously, we all can understand the sentiment of a father in such a situation, making this emotional argument for access to the only potential hope for their child. So that's obvious. But obviously, compassionate use or expanded access, all the terms that are used to describe this, it's very controversial. And in some cases, it may still be dangerous. Sometimes it may bring up and provide false hope. So you have one side will take the approach that it's a dangerous thing to go with. On the other hand, you have those who will say, well, maybe there should be access, but it should be regulated. And yet others will still say that it doesn't matter. It should be made available, and the decision should be totally the patient and the patient's family, and that's it. So we have against the right to try, dangerous, ineffective, unnecessary suffering, false hope. And then you have those who argue for, people have a right to make their own choices, regulations, and bureaucratic red tape. So if you join me on page 7 in your book, in exercise 1.1, do you consider it appropriate for individuals suffering from life-threatening illnesses to be granted access to experimental drugs that have not yet been approved as safe and effective? If yes, under what conditions? That's number one. Number two, are there any circumstances under which you believe drug companies should be required to provide access? We'll be revisiting these questions soon. If anyone have anything to quick comments on the matter?
Well, I think it should be available, especially if it passes the phase one testing. Because you do have testing involved. It's not just some elixir you're buying on the back of a truck. Right?
So with the help of the doctors in the room, phase one means what? That it's not dangerous?
No. Well,
safety and dose finding.
So after phase one?
After phase one is efficacy.
But phase one itself, if it passes phase one, does it mean that it's not dangerous?
No. At the dose they tested.
It means that it is safe. Doesn't mean bad things can't happen. Just means that they have arrived at a dose that they believe to be safe.
Mm-hmm. And phase two?
Is effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Initial effectiveness.
Tests, and dose escalation, right?
Yeah. Can do dose escalation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's, we'll be revisiting all these ideas. Another couple of just introductory thoughts before we launch into the next section. What's the objective of tonight's lesson? The objective is to answer a question of why would somebody, an observant Jewish family, if they unfortunately face a scenario where there's a loved one who has an illness, so of course the first thing you do is you look for medical treatment, which we'll discuss in a minute too, and you try to find the best place to be treated, the best medical professionals to treat, to be the ones treating. Of course, the Jews always look for the chief of the department, of course. And why settle for anything less? That said, an observant Jewish family is going to have another priority. They're also going to have a rabbi that they have an open line to throughout this process. Of course, we're talking about a situation that's, you know, a little bit more, let's just say, worse than average as far as the condition that they're facing. Maybe it's end of life, or maybe it's just something critical. They're going to have an open line to a rabbi. The question is why? If you want the rabbi to pray for you, I understand, but you don't need an open line for that. You can just let him know that you have an ill person, and please have him or her in mind in prayer. Why?
Well, because you have a trusted person that may have an outside opinion that's not emotionally involved. They don't have a vested interest. Well, they do, right, to do the right thing.
So that's like a friend. Any friend could fill that role.
Yeah, but they're not a religious or moral authority. That's a difference.
Okay, religious authority. Okay. So we're getting somewhere.
You need the Jewish perspective.
The Jewish perspective, because a Jewish person, everything they do in life, they want to know the Jewish perspective. It guides every aspect of life, most certainly when it comes to something so essential and existential and sensitive, like maybe life and death decisions. You certainly want to make sure it's being guided by Jewish law and Jewish values. And that's why there'll be a rabbi involved in the scenario. Now, that's so. The real reason for that will become clear as we make our way through tonight's lesson. And as I noted before, tonight especially, we're going to be trying to appreciate the process more than the bottom line decision. So let's begin with something that's a little bit general for the course as a whole. We're on page 8. We'll start with a short teaching from Maimonides, where he formulates the Torah commandment for an individual person to guard their life and avoid dangerous risks. Is a Jewish person allowed to put themselves in danger? So text number 1, Nick, would you like to read it for us, please?
It is a positive mitzvah to remove any obstacle that might pose a danger to life and to be extremely careful regarding these matters. As it is stated, be cautious and preserve your life.
Thank you. So what does this teaching tell us from Maimonides? That a person is not allowed to go into a dangerous situation. Be cautious and preserve your life. If somebody wants to do something risky, if there's a real risk to it, this teaching, this commandment will actually make it prohibited for a Jewish person to take that risk. So from here we know that you can't put yourself in danger. What about if somebody becomes ill? And that is not something, they didn't put themselves into that situation. Let's just call it an act of God. Do they have an obligation to try to address their medical situation? So yes, I have an obligation not to put myself in danger, but what if I am now in a dangerous situation because God put me there? Do I have an obligation to seek out medical treatment? What do you think?
Yeah, because the lesson could be in the second part of the problem.
Yeah, but I didn't do anything to myself. God did it to me, so why would I have the obligation to go find treatment?
How do you know God did it to you?
Because I didn't do it to myself.
But maybe it's random chance.
Well, nothing. We're taking for granted tonight that nothing in the world is random chance,
okay,
including me walking over to you. So, if that's the case, and we're not trying to understand why God would make somebody ill. That's not for this course. The fact is, if somebody became ill, but not by their own choosing, they didn't do anything reckless or negligent.
Okay.
Do they have an obligation to go seek medical attention? They do, but based on what?
Preservation of life. Because
Maimonides told us so far is you have to not put yourself in danger.
Well, you didn't put yourself in danger.
Except remove an
obstacle. So then where does the obligation come from?
To save a life is to save.
Just based on that teaching, I don't know if we have an obligation to pursue medical treatment.
But from this teaching alone?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. But from the next teaching,
I think it was a trick question.
In text 2a, and we'll come back to the theological question in a minute, by the way, because there is an argument, and it's I think certainly exists in other religions, that if God made me sick, who am I to go undo what God did? and go to a doctor. Why am I interfering with God's doing? And it's the same question you can ask about, there's an argument against giving charity. If God made somebody needy, who am I to step in and ruin God's plan? Nothing's by chance, nothing's by mistake, it's all intentional. If somebody is unhealthy, God made it that way, who am I to interfere and get healthy? You're changing God's plan. And the same is with charity and other areas, but we'll address that in a second. First, let's talk about the obligation, if there is one, to search out medical treatment. Joyce, would you like to read 2a, please? This is straight out of Exodus.
The cost of injury. If men quarrel and one strikes the other with a stone or a fist, and the victim does not die but is confined to bed, if the victim subsequently gets up and walks around outside on his staff, the assailant is cleared. He pays only for the victim's involuntary idleness and must provide for his cure.
Thank you. So what does it mean, provide for his cure? Go ahead with 2b, please. This is the Talmud commenting on that verse.
2b. Oh, the school of Rabbi Yishmael taught he must provide for his cure. This informs us that physicians are granted permission to heal.
Okay, and one more, 2c, please.
Okay. We do not argue. God has struck. Will the physician then go and heal?
Right. So, in other words, you have the obligation from here, from the fact that it says that you have to provide for his cure, which tells us that that physicians are granted permission to heal. Once Judaism has the position of believing in medicine, and the Torah gives a medical professional, a doctor, permission to heal, then, as Len was arguing, if I have the obligation to not put myself in danger, then not seeking out medical attention is putting myself in danger. So now we come to that conclusion. And it's not just not to put yourself in danger, it's also it's to get healthy if you became not healthy, but also to prevent that, to maintain a healthy life in general when everything is good and well. But for a second, before we continue, let's just address the theological question here. Who are we to interfere with God's world? If God did something, maybe we shouldn't interfere, we should leave it alone. So let's just read a very well-articulated teaching in the Midrash. If you would like to please, Octavia. Text number 3, page 15, Cultivating Life. In the English.
Okay, Cultivating Life. When Rabbi Yishmael and Akiva and one other individual strolled the streets of Jerusalem, they met an ill man. Rabbis, he asked them, tell me how I might be cured. Do such and such until you are cured, they replied. Who afflicted me, he pressed. God, they responded. You have interfered in an area beyond your jurisdiction, the invalid retorted. God afflicted me. You advise me how to be cured. Are you not defying God's will? What is your occupation? The rabbis questioned him. I am a farmer, he replied. This is my scythe in my hand. They pressed further. Who created the vineyard? God came to reply. You interfere in an area beyond your jurisdiction, they countered. God created it, and you are cutting its fruits. Do you not see the scythe in my hand? He rejoined. If I did not plow, trim, fertilize, and weed, nothing would grow. Foolish man, returned the rabbis, have you never heard the verse, as for the human, their days are like grass. Just as a tree will not sprout without the farmer weeding, fertilizing, and plowing, and after sprouting it will not live without water and fertilizer, but will die, the same is true of a human body. Drugs and medication are its fertilizers, and the doctor is the farmer.
Wonderful, thank you. So it's clear, theologically, that seeking out medical care is aligned with the divine plan, and actually it's actually we would call it so just recapping an obligation. The Torah commands us to avoid danger, seek healing, and maintain our health. But the idea here is, yes, God gives us a world, but he does so intentionally and makes us his partners. He makes us and gives us humans that can and should make changes to the world as God created it in order to improve and live life. So God created certain realities. Why did God create people who are needy? Because he didn't want to be the only provider. God wanted us to also be his partners and be providers. If there weren't needy people that needed us, then we would never be providers. We would never have the opportunity to give. God wanted us to be giving people. So he created an imbalance, and that way we can partner with him and be godlike. When we give and we share and we bestow, we are being godly. So with that, and we have this idea established. Of course, you know, when I lived in New York, there was a doctor that used to say, you know, we were leaving an appointment, and he's actually, I think, a Russian guy. So anyway, you'll understand. But he says, you know, when I do good, my patients, this is in Brooklyn, my patients say, thank God. When I don't, then they come to me. Then it's my fault. Only when I make a mistake, that's when I play a role. But when everything goes well, they thank God. So of course we have to thank the doctor and the medical professional. But we also have to thank God for blessing, first of all, giving wisdom to the medical professional and allowing for various medications or treatments to be created and recognize where the source of the blessing is. And when we do that, then everything is aligned and makes sense. Just like when Israel is attacked and there's a 99% successful, what's the word?
Defense.
Yeah. With everything working out so impeccably. If we only say how brilliant the engineers and et cetera are, then we're missing the point. They could still be brilliant, and it could be only 90% successful, which is what they anticipated. So we have to realize the source of the blessing. And we also have to acknowledge the messengers and the agents through who God's blessing actually manifests within reality, and that is the doctors. All good?
Yes.
Okay. So, by the way, in our daily prayers, in the Amida, which we say three times a day, one of the blessings there is for healing. We say it every day, and we say Rifa'enu Hashem b'nei Rafe. We acknowledge God as being the source of health and healing, and we pray for healing for ourselves or anybody else. At the Torah reading, you probably notice that names are kind of shared and mentioned for a blessing for healing as well. So all those things are helping us realize and acknowledge where the source of these blessings come from. And that way we have the faith and at the same time acknowledge through who God sends these blessings. So, the Jewish religious perspective on caring for our health, and as we said, avoiding any danger, it has a unique and defining feature, and that is that it's not just a right or a choice. It's unique in Judaism. We said we have an obligation to seek out medical care or medical treatment. If you walk over to the average person and just ask them who owns your body and whose choice is it if you want to seek out medical help or not, they're going to say, it's my choice. It's my body. It's my choice. I don't have to. Of course, I'm blessed that we live in this time where there's so much medical care available, but to say that I'm obligated to seek it out, who would ever suggest such a thing? Would any American say that they're obligated to seek out medical treatment? No, it's uniquely Jewish. Because our attitude to our body and to our health is not one based on rights, it's based on obligation. We actually have an obligation to seek out medical treatment. Why is that? Why would it be an obligation? If it's mine, you could do what you want with it. You can use it, you can abuse it, just like anything else you own. So why would that be? That's because it's not mine. You're right that if it was mine, I could do whatever I want with it, and it's my right. But in Jewish belief, our body is not ours. It's a deposit. It belongs to God even while we are living our life, soul in a body, and seemingly living our independent life, and we should have the right to do whatever we want. But the truth is that even when we have it, it's not really ours. In Hebrew, it's called a pikadon. We're just looking after it for God. God gave us the body to look after it, and we have to do our job. And that's another reason why we have to look to Torah and to Jewish values of how to take care of our health, because God gave us the manual of how to take care of what He gave us. He gave us the body as a deposit. Our bodies were given to us by God to fulfill our life's mission. We must do all we can to upkeep our health. So the reason why it's an obligation is because that's how the owner put it. When we were given our body, it was with that understanding that you're going to look after it and take care of it. And by the way, this pertains to a lot of areas in life, and we'll come to it in other classes later in this course, relating to end of life, relating to after death, how one treats the body. Big issue, cremation today is very popular, all that. And what we do with our body, even after death, is all instructed and guided by Torah, specifically by the perspective that it's not ours, it's God's, and that's how it needs to be treated. And because of this idea that it's not ours, so in text number 5, Len, did you please?
Okay.
If authority, we don't necessarily read 100% of the text, but you can definitely do so in your own time.
It is forbidden to hit another person, even with their consent, for we have absolutely no authority over bodies to permit that they be struck, denigrated, or pained in any way.
So this is codified in Jewish law. If somebody tells you to punch them in the face or to do anything to their body, we are not allowed to listen to them and to do it and to inflict that harm on their body, because they have no right to give me permission to do that to them. It's not theirs to tell me what to do with it. And this is a very important idea, as we noted, and It manifests itself in various different ways, by the way. We can't do what we want with our bodies. It relates to tattoos and other things. So the idea is that it's not ours to do what we like with it. All good? Okay. So let's go to page 19 to exercise 1.2. Based on the Jewish approach to health and healing outlined above, do you consider it appropriate for individuals with life-threatening illnesses to turn to experimental drugs that have not yet been approved as safe and effective? So we have an obligation to look after our health. Is it appropriate to turn to experimental drugs?
But what if the drug actually ends up shortening your life?
Great observation. You say no?
I say no, because if there's no proof, at least of some safety, there's no indications that it's going to be helpful at all or healing in any way. I mean, the original question with the phase one, at least there's some indication of safety.
Until when is it called experimental?
Approved by the FDA.
Okay, so it could already be, we can have more information about it after phase two or whatever, before approval, but it's already been effective.
Only if phase two. Phase one is not effective.
So let's say phase two. I mean, did we say only phase one before?
No.
No.
In the original question, it said phase one.
Yeah, I'm with you.
But yeah, I agree.
You're with what?
Okay, so in a phase one drug, it is being tested for safety, not efficacy, by definition. So there's no indication the drug has any positive effect on an illness at that point. But every drug that's ever been effective in a big way was a phase one drug once. So you tell me. I don't know the answer. I know what I think, but I don't know the answer.
Okay. So here's the issue in this case. So preserving life, generally, what did we say so far? This we already established, that we have to avoid danger. We also have to pursue a cure. So generally speaking, these two things are two sides of one coin. Avoid danger, pursue a cure. We can do both of them. Problem is, what happens when these two are conflicting with each other? So I have an obligation to avoid danger and an obligation to pursue a cure. But what if pursuing the cure actually puts me into danger? So I can't do both of these obligations simultaneously. The same person in the same situation. How can I? So these two big ideas conflict with each other when it comes to an experimental treatment or a risky surgery, for that matter. It doesn't have to be a treatment. If there's a surgery which may be successful, but there's maybe a strong chance that the individual won't survive the surgery. Once again, they're pursuing the cure, but they're putting themselves in danger. So how do we go about resolving this conflict between these two obligations that we have? And that's really our big idea that we're going to try to resolve tonight. Good, right? Okay. So, in order to appreciate this, we're going to explore another important key terms that we're going to be dealing with for the rest of the class are as follows. So make sure you you pick up on them. They're actually on page 20 in figure 1.1. So there's two terms, and they originate in Hebrew. And this is halachic authorities utilize these terms, but I'll try to use them in English, but it's good to know what I'm referring to anyway in Hebrew. So generally speaking, a person's life is described with the term in Hebrew called chaye sha'ah, chaye olam, the other way. Generally speaking, life is defined by chaye olam, which means long-term life. Generally, a healthy individual, their perspective and their attitude to life is that, we're here to stay. I mean, obviously everybody knows that 120 comes at some point, but there's no reason to, let's say after 40, once you realize that you're not living forever. So, but nonetheless, you still don't have any concern about your health or about your life. You're looking forward to a long-term life with God's help. That's one term. The other term is called chaye sha'ah, which means short-term life. And, as you would imagine, as a rabbi, whatever, it's not infrequent. Maybe, unfortunately, just 2 weeks ago, a good friend in his 60s came to me and said he was diagnosed. And if he doesn't do any treatments, he was told he has about 2 years. Suddenly, this guy's life is just in an instant went from chaye olam to chaye sha'ah, from thinking that he could live forever, and suddenly there's an expiration date. And it changes everything. So there's two different, very different attitudes and two different realities to life, and these are going to be the basically the driving force behind our attempt to find a resolution to these ideas. So we understand what the terms mean. We introduce them. Just to be clear, the Jewish perspective, there is, so when somebody finds themselves in a chaye sha'ah mode, when you're in a chaye sha'ah mode, when you're in a short-term life mode, then what do you tell yourself? Then you say, well, you have a treatment in front of you, you have a possible way to find a cure. Well, there's nothing to lose if treatment fails, since the patient's lifespan is already limited. So the equation is different. Once there's an expiration date, I'm just going to use that term, even though it's not the best. Once I'm in a short-term life mode, then why shouldn't I do it if I have nothing to lose? The Jewish perspective, however, is that there is something to lose if treatment fails, since every moment of life is precious. So here's the issue. We said before, so the difference of the two attitudes, as we're saying, when it's a short-term attitude, then you may think, why shouldn't I have the surgery or try the treatment because I have nothing to lose anyway? And as we said before, from a secular perspective, It could be argued that each person should make their own choice, and you can decide for yourself what you want to do, if I want to put myself at risk or not. But as we noted, we don't own our bodies. We can't make decisions for ourselves. God Almighty owns our bodies. If that's the case, then we have to follow God's attitude and perspective on life. What is that? That there is no such thing as any amount of life is never looked at callously. Just because someone was given a certain amount of time doesn't mean that now they can risk or jeopardize their life more than if they had decades and decades to live. It's still not theirs. In other words, from God's perspective, every single moment of life, even if someone is terminally ill, every single moment is sacred and every moment is eternal. If that's the case, I can't decide, well, I have nothing to lose anyway, might as well try this treatment. I don't have the authority to say that, because there is definitely something to lose, as we said. Because if I'm going to take this treatment and there's a chance that I may shorten and jeopardize my short-term life, that means I am taking into my hands and becoming the authority to decide that I can risk shortening my life even more. So, we have this teaching here also from Maimonides. Jacob, could I trouble you to read text number 6, please? This just brings home the important perspective about the sanctity of every moment of life.
If a building collapses on Shabbat, and we are unsure whether someone is buried beneath its rubble, we must clear the rubble as a potential rescue attempt, although such activity is generally prohibited on Shabbat. If we indeed discover a living person, even if they are crushed by debris to the extent of being mortally wounded, we nevertheless continue clearing the rubble off the victim to allow them to live a short while longer.
So, Shabbat and Shabbat observance, we know in Judaism it's right at the top. Nonetheless, well, we all know that you suspend almost any law in Judaism for the sake of life. Life comes first, with 3 exceptions, but that's not for now. Shabbat is always violated if there's somebody's life at stake. Always. The question is, what if you find somebody under this rubble, God forbid, 9/11, or that condominium building in Surfside, Florida collapses, 30% of the people were Jewish. There were observant Jews there, unfortunately, and this question is a real question. Do you continue to remove the rubble because there's a chance that somebody may still be alive? So Jewish law tells us that even if somebody is injured, seriously injured, and you know it's just a matter of whatever, hours or even just minutes to live, you still do everything you can to save them just to be able to have those moments of life. Because every moment of life is sacred. And there's no such thing as one moment being more sacred than another. It's not like at the end of life, well, you're at the end anyway, so we are more lax about it. There's no such thing. The last breath is as eternal as any other. And this, by the way, this informs Jewish people. I mean, and these things do get complicated, of course, and as we'll say later, but I'm going to just say it already, that these things need to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. If there's ever a situation, of course we consult a rabbi, usually an expert in medical ethics. If somebody calls me with something of this, usually, unless it's a very obvious situation that I already experienced once, usually I'll reach out to an international expert on these topics. And that should always be the case. But generally speaking, in my own experience, in the days when I was at Columbia Hospital with my father, I remember the doctor coming in and saying just point blank, you know, that he's not going to be recovering from this. And in their view, there's no reason to hold on to things and just schlep it out for another couple months, because they know what's happening. But nonetheless, in Jewish law, we still will maintain whatever it is, it's the machines or this, that, or the other, we don't do anything, generally speaking, you don't do anything to hasten death, even if it's inevitable anyway. So, and
that's the law, too.
What's that?
That's the law.
What, you can't pull a plug?
You can, but it's not easy. Withdrawal support. You can't just do it because you feel like it.
No, but
if there
the consensus.
There are a lot of families who to me, it's pretty clear that they could have lived for months and the family decided, based on what they were told, that this is it. So why keep him in this state and schlep it on?
They'll say, he wouldn't have wanted to live that way.
Like, I see that. I mean, yeah. So, but nonetheless, in generally speaking, again, I'm going to keep on saying generally, we extend life as much as possible because every moment of life is sacred. So this just drives home our question even more. The question becomes even more, even stronger with this obligation that we have to preserve life. And coming back to our case study of Radha. So which obligation between the two do we, which one takes priority? Do we try to avoid risk and not do anything, or do we seek healing? Or to use the terms that we introduced before, if we want to preserve short-term life, then we do one thing. Meaning, if we are focusing on chayei sha'ah, on short-term life, then we would avoid risk, because if you take a risk and try do the treatment or do the surgery, you may lose the short-term life that you do have. But if you want to try to preserve long-term life, then you do want to take the risk, because you may at least get, there's a chance that you'll get the cure and you'll get long-term life. So the question is, which one do we look for? Is that clear and crystallized? Okay. So that's the bottom line. Is there a way to resolve this dilemma? So now we're going to kind of get into to the struggle and to the process of what happens when a rabbi is reached out to with a scenario like this. So let's dive in to some of the halachic responsa on the matter, on these matters. Let's start with text 7a. We're going to go back to Nick, and you'll take us through the sevens. This is a question that was posed to Rabbi Yaakov Reicher, who was a rabbi in several communities in Germany and France in the late 17th and early 18th centuries.
I received an inquiry submitted by an expert doctor regarding a terminally ill patient. The unanimous medical prognosis is that the patient will die within the next couple of days. However, the physician suggests that there is a medicine that might cure him, but might cause him to die within a couple of hours of taking it. Is it permitted to administer the medicine? My response is that this is a matter of life and death, which therefore requires exceptionally careful consideration. It is necessary to thoroughly review the relevant passages in the Talmudic and Halakhic codes, for one who kills a single individual is considered as having destroyed an entire world, and conversely, the act of saving a single individual is considered as having sustained an entire world.
Okay, well, it's broken up a little bit, so one thing at a time. So, for starters, Rabbi Reicher, first he says, obviously this is a very heavy, this is a loaded question, and we have to really investigate it thoroughly and look at the sources, because this is not a light issue. There's a life at stake. So continue with 7b, please.
Apparently, it would seem appropriate to apply the principle of shev va'al taseh. It is preferable to let the situation sit where it is and make no proactive move, out of concern for the preservation of chayei sha'ah. This consideration applies even in the case of gozes, a dying patient in the final throes of life.
Okay, so the first thing he says is, and he's going to say more, but the first thing he says is, well, at least do no harm. There's too much at stake here, and there's no good answer. There's too much to lose either way. So he invokes this classic Talmudic principle that in situations where both ideas are bad, then you just do nothing. At least you didn't act. Nobody took action, and no one did anything. There's no particular person that's associated with what the next thing that's going to happen is. So that's the first thing he says. Shev al tase means sit and do nothing. But he doesn't stop over there. So by the way, this is true also in civil matters. It's the same principle will sometimes be used if there's no good answer. In our case, because both courses of action are not desirable, whichever one you take, you're jeopardizing the other. So we would assume that it's preferable to just be passive and refrain from treatment. Don't take the treatment. And that way, at least you're not doing anything to bring about any result. However, this is the first thing Rabbi Reischer says, but then, after putting forth this analysis, he goes on to demonstrate that actually, he remembers, that he didn't have Google to just bring up all the sources. So this is, there's a process here. The question is if he even had all these books in front of him, or maybe he was relying on memory. Who knows? So after this, he said, you know what? This question has actually been addressed before in the Talmud. There's a Talmudic teaching that we can draw upon to find guidance for this matter. So what was the issue? During the Talmudic era, there were many heathens who had great hatred for the Jews. What else is new? It was therefore considered risky to seek out medical treatment from a doctor who was a heathen, because you may be risking your life and he may do something to kill you. This was a real threat. And by the way, we don't have to go back 2,000 years for this. I actually literally saw a letter that was written within the last few months to the medical board in the state of Florida about a dentist. I even wrote down the name, Fadi Kablawi. Yeah, you can even look it up. You can Google it. And this dentist in North Miami Beach is also an imam, and he had sermons that were broadcasted live on social media in recent months, calling for the death of Zionists and the death of Jews, and that Allah should bring death upon Jews. Now, the vast majority of Jews in South Florida would probably call themselves Zionists, but nonetheless, he didn't only say Zionists, he said Jews in general. And I saw a letter of somebody reaching out to the medical board saying that this guy should lose his license. He's a dentist. A Jewish person could end up on his chair in North Miami Beach, after hearing what comes out of his mouth. So this is, unfortunately, it's modern day. It happened 80 years ago, and it happened in the Talmudic era as well. This was a real dilemma. So should I go to this doctor, meaning someone desperately needed medical attention, should I go to this doctor even though I may be putting myself in danger? That same question of these two obligations conflicting with each other. I have to avoid danger, I have to seek out treatment, but I'm putting myself in danger at the same time. So Rabbi Reischer, after first suggesting that we do nothing, turns back to this Talmudic teaching. And let's hear it now, in 8a, being that you started.
Rabbi Yochanan stated, when it is doubtful whether an invalid will live or die, and the only physician available is a heathen whose animosity towards Jews leads us to suspect that he might deliberately kill the patient, we do not approach the physician for treatment. However, if we are certain that without treatment the patient will die, we may approach that physician for treatment. Are we not placing the patient's chayesah in potential jeopardy? The Talmud responds, in such a case, the concern for chayesah can be disregarded.
Okay, so what's the Talmudic teaching? Rabbi Yochanan says that if you are not well, but let's just say it's a 50-50 chance, if you're going to survive it, you don't go to such a doctor to put yourself at risk. But if you are dying basically for certain, then you can go to that doctor. Why? Again, he uses the same term of chaye sha'ah, of short-term life. He says, we're not concerned. In a case like this, where death is certain, We're not concerned about short-term life, about preserving short-term life, and we do take the risk. So Rabbi Reicher is drawing upon this Talmudic teaching, and he, so far, it seems like we have an indication of what the answer would be to this patient, of this question that he got about someone who had was just a matter of days, but if they took the treatment, it may advance it to a matter of hours. So the Talmud then questions, where does Rabbi Yochanan, who just said that we can disregard short-term life, the Talmud asks, where did Rabbi Yochanan get this teaching from? What's he basing it on? What's the source for him coming to this conclusion? This is in the Talmud. So we go to 8b, please.
Okay. On what grounds are we permitted to waive the concern from Chayesha?
Okay, so here's the question. Rabbi Yochanan, what's your proof? What's your backing? So the Talmud responds with proof from a biblical incident. So Rabbi Reicher turned to the Talmud. In the Talmud turns to a biblical incident for backing for Rabbi Yochanan, who is saying that we should not be so, that we could compromise or jeopardize the short-term life. What biblical incident does he turn to? So there was a king of Aram by the name of Ben-Hadad, and he laid siege to Samaria, that land that the Jews have nothing to do with, the capital of the kingdom of Israel. And there was already a famine in Samaria. By the way, it was the seat of the northern kingdom of the 10 tribes. Jerusalem was the seat of the 2 tribes. Samaria was of the 10 tribes. And this king, king of Aram, laid siege to Samaria, and it worsened the famine that existed already. Circumstances were beyond desperate. A donkey's head sold for 80 silver pieces, the Talmud says, about how desperate the situation was then, and worse. So the prophet at the time was Elisha, who was a student of Elijah, and he foretold that miraculously there would be food in the near future. At that time, there were 4 lepers, who the story in Kings 2 tells us. There were 4 lepers. Now, we're just calling them lepers, but it's not the leprosy that we know of. This is a spiritual disease that really doesn't exist anymore. But the way we went about it was, and this is, of course, from the Bible itself, that if somebody was a leper, they needed to be outside of the camp. They needed to be outside of the city. So these 4 lepers were outside of the city. And the story continues that they said to themselves, so what are we going to do? We're starving. We're starving hungry. If we go into the city where there's a famine, we're going to die. If we stay here, we're going to die. Let's go to the camp of the enemy, of Aram, the Aramians. Let's go try to get food from there. Now, if we get food, there's a chance we may get food, okay? That's great. And if we don't, then we'll die over there. But if we stay here, we're also going to die. So what are our options here? It's either death here or death over there in the Aramean camp. But there's a chance that maybe we'll get food over there and be able to relieve our hunger. This is what happened. So let's read text 9. Joyce, if you would be so kind, please.
4 men stricken with Sarat lingered outside the city gates. They told each other, why should we sit here until we die of starvation? If we decide to enter the city, we will die there due to the famine in the city. If we stay here, we will also die. So now let us go and defect to the Aramean camp. If they spare us, we will be provided food and remain alive. And if they kill us, we are going to die anyway.
Thank you. So the story continues that they approached the camp of the Arameans. They were shocked to see that it was deserted. A miracle had occurred, and the Arameans suddenly fled, and they left all their provisions behind. So these 4 lepers relieved themselves of their hunger, and they had something to eat, and then they brought the news back to the city that this is what happened, and everyone else can go get food. So first they performed a test to make sure it wasn't an ambush. And once they established that that was actually the case, the city officials opened the gates, and that ended the terrible hunger in the city, and everybody was able to have the food that they needed. That's the story. But what's relevant to our discussion is the calculation that they made, as we said before. And the Talmud uses their calculation as evidence for the ruling of Rabbi Yochanan. If you remember, Rabbi Yochanan said that it's okay to jeopardize short-term life. And that was about going to the doctor, to the potentially dangerous doctor. He said for short-term life, it's okay to take the risk. And now the question was, what's the source of Rabbi Yochanan? Says the Talmud, the source is this story. Because these four lepers were willing to undergo the risk of being killed, because if they did nothing, they would certainly die of hunger. If they approached the camp, at least they have a chance of being saved. So this teaches us that the value of normal life is so important, meaning to take some action to try to extend your life and get your life back to normal, is so important and so essential that you can jeopardize your short-term life for a chance at a long-term life. It was on this basis that Rabbi Yochanan was able to rule that one would be permitted to be treated by such a doctor, because if you're in mortal danger, then at least by going to the doctor, you have a chance of restoring your life. Okay? So now Rabbi Reischer, who's brought all this stuff into the response to the question that he got, now he's able to apply this reasoning to a case of high-risk treatment. Let's see how he concludes this.
If the possibility exists for this treatment to completely cure the patient from his illness, we can certainly disregard the concern for Hayei Sha'a. This approach has clear precedence in the aforementioned Talmudic case. Consequently, in our case, since the patient will certainly die without intervention, we ignore the certainty that he will survive on his own for a few more days and seize the chance of fully healing him. The above decision, notwithstanding, a physician must not take this decision lightly. It is necessary for the physician to weigh the situation carefully, to consult with the other expert physicians in that city, and in the case of divergent views, to abide by the consensus of the majority of experts and to procure the agreement of the local
authority. Thank you very much. So this response from Rabbi Reischer and the other sources that we quoted highlight the value that must be attributed to any life, whether it's short-term life or long-term life, and it must be with any calculations have to be with due deliberation, and that's because the failure to act will result in the loss of the chance of achieving long-term life. So applying this ruling to our case study back to Radha, it would seem, should she take this experimental treatment? If nothing is done, then she was given, generally speaking, she was given an expiration date. What did they say? I mean,
5 years, 10 years,
100%. Or a little longer, another few years, maybe 8, whatever it was. But there was a specific time limit that was given. So if there's a treatment available based on Rabbi Reischer, what would we say? That we should that she should take the treatment, because it's okay. Basically, if doing nothing, if staying where you are means certain death, then it's okay to jeopardize short-term life in order to possibly secure the chance of long-term life. Good? Okay. So let's just catch up here. So his first suggestion he advanced from and said that short-term life can be risked if failure to act will result in the loss of a chance at long-term life. So the question now is, we said that it's okay to jeopardize short-term life, but what's the definition of short-term life? That's the big question that remains. So we have the source from the Talmud, and we have Rabbi Yochanan that Rabbi Reischer brought that they could take this treatment. But in that scenario, he wrote very clearly that this patient had a few days. Taking the treatment may make it a few hours. But the question is, how much short-term life is considered short-term? So we're left with two questions. And by the way, just it's worthwhile pausing for a moment. The big idea of our class tonight, we just got. Not just. We got already over the last hour. First it was our attitude towards our lives, who owns them, who owns our life, and the fact that we don't, and our attitude toward taking care of our health is one not of a right but of obligation. And then we kind of got into the head of Rabbi Reischer as he struggled with trying to figure out a solution for this big question of how to deal with that case that was brought to him. So for the remaining time, we're just going to explore these two questions, but as we'll see, there's a very broad spectrum of opinions when it comes to these matters. But let's just have a little bit of fun with the remaining time. So question number one that remains, what is the definition of Chaye Sha'ah? So the case that we presented, as we said, was very short. But what if the patient would live without treatment? Let's say you did nothing, they would have not just a few days, maybe it would be a few months. What if they had a year or 2 years to live? Would it still be considered short-term life that it's okay to jeopardize in order to, for the chance of getting back long-term life?
Depends on their age, wouldn't it?
It depends on their age.
Maybe.
I mean, it's not just the age; it's their condition.
And the treatment.
So the question is, when is it acceptable to take the risk? Where do we draw the line? When do you go over from short-term life to long-term life and say, well, let it just be? I mean, if he has 2 years of life, maybe just leave it alone. That's number one. And number two, how much risk is permitted as far as the treatment is concerned? So what chances does it have in order to say that you could take it? Does it have to be 50-50? Or what if there's a 30% chance that it may work? Is that sufficient to jeopardize the short-term life? So let's try to address each of these two questions with the little bit of time that we have remaining. First one first, what is the definition of short-term life? So in the story of the lepers, where they were suffering from hunger, they were in a dangerous condition. And as we said already, it meant certain death if they didn't find food. So it's reasonable to conclude that one necessary factor in defining what short-term life means is that one has to be diagnosed with a terminal condition. It has to be that they got a terminal condition. And it will definitely lead to death if there's no intervention. So the first rabbi we have on this topic is, on this question, is Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook, who was the first chief rabbi of Israel, also ideological leader. What's that?
I've heard of him. He's supposed to be this incredible mind.
They say he was a pretty cool guy. And and ideological leader, by the way, of the modern religious Zionist movement. He's highly respected, especially by this segment of the modern Zionist movement, or religious Zionist movement, as they would call it, maybe otherwise called the Mizrahi movement, otherwise called as the Kippah Sruga movement. Everything in Israel is based on the kippah that you wear. So this would be the knitted kippah camp. Maybe you would fit in. So, literally, religious Zionists, it's a description, a knitted kippah. Mine isn't knitted, as you can see. But that's all, of course, insignificant. The point is, Rabbi Cook says as follows. Where are we? Octavia, please. 11. Text 11, please.
Text 11. Terminal boundaries. The boundary marking the transition from
Tishai Olam is not clearly delineated. However, it is logical to assume that as long as we know that the illness is already terminal, regardless of how much time will pass until death arrives, it is considered Shaya.
Okay, so Rabbi Cook says that as long as this person has a diagnosis with certain death, even if it's not in the very near future, it's still called short-term life. So let's just say my friend who told me a couple weeks ago that he was told 2 years if no treatment, Rabbi Cook would see this as short-term life. And if that's the case, you can risk with a treatment or a surgery or whatever. That's Rabbi Cook. There's other authorities that say that if it's a significant amount of time or a substantial amount of time, then that wouldn't be considered short-term life. So let's just say 2 years. So Rabbi Cook would say that is short-term. But others say that being that it's more of a substantial amount of time, that wouldn't be considered short-term. And if you have a couple years, even though you were told that there's an end date, nonetheless, it still would not fall into that category. But the question is, we're still stuck. We need a little bit more definition. So for that, we'll go to another rabbi in text 12. And just one word of introduction to Rabbi Kluger in text 12. I'm sure everyone here knows, has heard of the word treif, right? What does treif mean?
Not kosher food.
That is correct, but it's not the whole story. Anyone know what the word actually means?
Torn.
Torn is correct. That's what terefa means in Hebrew. In other words, if all it meant was unkosher, then just say not kosher. What is it about the word treif? So the word means torn or mauled, and the reason why we use this term is because an animal, in order for an animal to be slaughtered and be considered kosher meat, it has to be a healthy animal. It can't be a sickly animal. And an animal that does have a blemish internally that will disqualify it from being used for kosher meat is called a trefa. And the reason for that is because these injuries usually came about by them being mauled by another animal. That's what could make it happen. By the way, whenever a chicken or any animal is slaughtered, and I saw this myself once when I went to a slaughterhouse in Postville, Iowa, and they check, even after they slaughter the animal, they check to make sure there was no blemishes that they didn't know about before. In fact, you may have also heard the term glatz kosher.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Look at the lungs.
It means very kosher, right? But what does the word glatz mean? Glatz, literally, it's a Yiddish word, actually. It means smooth, because they check the lungs after slaughtering it to make sure that there was no blemish or no hole, etc. And only then is it kosher. So a lot goes into it. And that's what glatz means. Glatz kosher means that that it was checked and it's all good to go. So back to trefa. So an animal that is not kosher or can't even be kosher, even if you slaughter it the right way, is called a trefa. Now let's see what Rabbi Kluger has to say. Text 12, Len, please.
The definition of chayei sha'a is not clearly spelled out in Jewish law. It is clear that a life expectancy of 1 to 2 years cannot be considered chayei sha'a, because if so, what is chayei sha'olam? After all, everyone is mortal, and what difference is there between 1 year, 2 years, or 100 years, seeing that no one lives forever? Are we to categorize all life as chayei sha'a?
Keep going.
Oh, sorry. Nor does it appear correct to say that chayei sha'a only refers to a situation in which the patient will die from a specific illness for which they presently seek a cure, and not from other ailments. What difference should it make what illness will cause the patient's death? Rather, it should appear that as terefa is defined as an ill person or animal that will not live more than 12 months, Similarly, anyone whose illness will prevent them from surviving for more than 12 months has entered the category of Shaha. Conversely, if the illness will cause death only after 12 months, the interval is not considered Shaha alone.
So, thank you for that. So, Rabbi Shlomo Kluger, who passed away in 1869, by the way, he says, and kind of gives us some definition for what does short-term life mean. So he borrows this concept from the animal. When is an animal called a trepha? If the injury that it has will make it not survive more than 12 months. If it will, then it's not called a trepha. Similarly, we can apply this to a human being as well. That if somebody is given 12 months, longer than 12 months, that would not be considered short-term life. Because it's quite substantial. But 12 months or less would fall into that category of short-term life, and then you would be able to take this chance. So, we said what a terefa means, so defining chayei sha'ah, what is considered short-term life. Rabbi Cook said any terminal illness, doesn't matter how long he'll actually live. Rabbi Kluger just gave us less than 12 months. Okay, so we addressed that question. And by the way, this is just kind of, we're dabbling in these in addressing these questions. If a rabbi will actually get a call, you never know. It all depends on the variables of what's before him, and the who, and the what, and the when, and all the factors need to be gathered, and a decision is made based on the information he has in that particular situation. The point here is that we get the spectrum of opinions that exist within Jewish law. A rabbi, an expert on medical ethics, will have access to all these opinions and try to come to a decision, and the main thing he'll do is find backing within these opinions for what he thinks is the right path in this particular situation. Let's just revisit the final question, and then we will close. How much risk is acceptable? So let's take a look at a couple of the texts. Jacob, please, number 13.
However, this permission to operate is valid only if the chances of life and death as a result of the surgery are equal, but not if, in the majority of cases, the patient will die as a result of the operation.
Thank you. So here we get one approach. First, we say that we basically need 50-50. There has to be a decent chance of success. However, we have the other extreme as well from another great authority, Rabbi Chaim Moser Grodzinski, passed away in 1940, and he was a leader of Lithuanian Jewry. And he says, actually, he's much more liberal. Want to read text 14, please, as well, Jacob?
When faced with a case in which there is no alternative hope for a patient's survival, we disregard our concern for Hayei Sha'ah in exchange for even a remote possibility that the patient will be healed.
Thank you. So here we have our different extremes. Rabbi Grodzinski, any risk. Rabbi Waldenberg, 50%. And the question is, even... as you mentioned before, what kind of reputation does this treatment have? It needs to be proven to a decent degree. Rabbi Orbach was also a great authority in Jerusalem. More recent, he passed away in 1995. He says that even for an experimental treatment. So again, here we have just the spectrum of opinions in this matter. And as we said, the main thing is to take everything into consideration and the specific scenario before the rabbi, and a decision will be made. So let's just close with coming back to our case study. So we have a range of opinions, and let's just say, based on what we have with the definitions of chayei sha'ah and the risks that we can take, coming back to Rada. So, according to some opinions, Rada would qualify under the criteria of Chayei Sha'ah, right? Because what did we say? Chaye Sha'ah, according to the more liberal ones, Rabbi Cook, I believe, was as long as there is a limit, then even if it's longer than 12 months, it's still considered short-term life. For Rada, what did they say? Age 5, age 8, yes, was longer than 12 months. So to the opinions that were more liberal, she would be able to try a risky or experimental treatment. However, to the opinions that say that 12 months is short-term life, and she has longer than that, then to those opinions, they would say that there isn't enough enough of a compelling reason to take that risk and jeopardize your short-term life. Yeah? As far as obligation is concerned, nobody would suggest that there is an obligation to take that treatment for in Rada's case. Meaning there's a spectrum of opinions of if she can take it, but to say that she must take it, nobody would say that there is, because as we said, the chances are pretty low and not significant enough to be able to say that. But the main takeaway of tonight is, as we stated, of who the owner of life is, the author of life, who owns our bodies, and because of that, when it comes to a Jew, the process of the way the attitude and the way we go about these things, sometimes is it may be surprising to your average American, who may not appreciate these Jewish values, that we have an obligation to take care of our health, and therefore when it comes to a situation that is sensitive, where life and death are being confronted, then we must look deep into Torah, into Jewish values, with the guidance of an expert and a reliable one, to make sure that we make the right decisions in a critical moment like this. Let's just go to the closing video, and with that, we will conclude.
Experimental treatments. 1. Jewish law considers preserving our health a